Welcome, everyone, to the On Poly podcast. I'm Steve Paikin.
And I'm John Michael McGrath.
We're on every weekday during this 43rd Ontario election campaign. Today on the pod, the NDP blitz battleground Scarborough. The Liberals turn their focus to the classroom. The Greens have a big housing plan to pitch. And we'll weigh in on the leaders' presentation skills. It's Wednesday, May the 5th, 2022, so let's get to it. JMM, we're going to start today with Battleground Scarborough. That's six ridings. In the last House, the Conservatives had four, the Liberals had one, and the NDP had one seat. Andrea Horvath did four events in Scarborough today alone. What's going on?
You know, this is incredibly competitive territory in the election. The Tories obviously have seats they are looking to hold on to. Doug Ford is personally very popular in Scarborough, and the party brand is doing well there. But the Liberals, before 2018 anyway, the Liberals had a lock on those seats in Scarborough and held almost all of them for an uninterrupted period after 2003. And then the New Democrats got their first Scarborough seat in the last election. Obviously, would like to hang on to that and build from that, but. But it's, we're going to see really, really intense competition in Scarborough, presumably over the rest of the campaign as well.
Scarborough has always seemed to me to be very bellwether. You know, I mean, whoever wins the government tends to win the majority of the seats in Scarborough, don't you find?
Yeah, and it's also it's more diverse. As both demographically than I think a lot of people necessarily assume. I think in certain people's minds, perhaps, Scarborough still resonates to the idea of like a sleepy suburb of Toronto, when in fact it is an extremely diverse community with a very substantial mix of incomes. So you get a lot of the politics of the whole province in Scarborough itself.
Now, the NDP did have a bunch of announcements that they made in Scarborough today. The biggest one being, of course, their new DentaCare program that they want to pitch. Why don't you give us some of the details on that?
Sure. The New Democrats are doing this in concert, they say, with the recent confidence and supply agreement federally, where the federal Liberals and New Democrats have agreed to bring forward a dental care program. The Ontario NDP want to build on that, and they would provide families with a household income of less than $200,000 a year with a provincially, publicly funded dental care program. The NDP are also saying, NDP leader Andrew Horvath says that while they are building on that federal confidence and supply agreement, she was very clear that if that agreement were to fall apart, not that anybody in the NDP wants that to happen, but if that agreement were to fall apart, the NDP government would still make that program whole. They want to make sure this goes forward, whether or not federal politics allow it.
Now, I gather one of the interesting comparisons here is that the federal program, the confidence and supply agreement the Liberals and NDP have in Ottawa, would be for those who make $90,000 a year or less. And the one that Andrea Horvath was pitching today is for those with incomes of $200,000 or less, which you and I have joked about in the past, the NDP kind of considers to be middle-class people. Now, we both know if you make 200 grand a year, you're not middle-class in the province of Ontario. You're actually in the 1%. But how are they going to figure out all of that? I mean, somewhere, some way, someone's got to figure out how to make those two plans mesh.
Right. And I suspect a large chunk of it will simply be that the province will end up paying more. The feds are not going to pay, at least if you assume that confidence and supply agreement is as written, the feds are not going to pony up to help make households with $200,000 a year in income have access to this program. So that'll be something that a provincial government would have to pay for. Probably relevant at this point to mention that while the NDP have provided their platform, they have not provided a full costing yet. Just to remind our listeners that the NDP said that they wanted to wait until the provincial budget was released, and then they would base their costing off of the most recent financial numbers from the province of Ontario. We have not seen that yet. Ms. Horvath again was asked about the timing of when that costing would be out and says it will be coming in the very near future.
That is one of those great expressions, right? They always say it's coming soon, or it's coming in the fullness of time,
in the days ahead.
Yes. Or yeah, exactly. Well, now, when you go to Scarborough, you one of the things that makes Scarborough different is that you don't just give interviews to the English language press. There are ethnic press, as they are called, which you really do, if you want to be a player in Scarborough, have to spend some time with. And Andrea Horvath did that today as well, didn't she?
Yes, Andrea Horvath doing a round of interviews both with Chinese community media and Tamil community media. And, you know, this is something that you learn very quickly in provincial politics, that you have to take every community's media seriously. And both the current premier and his predecessor, Kathleen Wynne, you know, they had people dedicated in their offices to doing media outreach specifically to these communities who are, not represented in the, let's call it, you know, traditional mainstream media.
Now, not to be outdone, Stephen Del Duca and the Liberals maybe saw that Andrea Horvath and the NDP did four events today, so the Liberals did five. That's a full schedule, I gotta say. Starting in Woodbridge, the riding, of course, that Mr. Del Duca used to represent and that he would like to represent again. He's going up against Michael Tobolo, who is an associate minister of mental health and addictions in the Progressive Conservative cabinet. But Del Duca also did an interview on Bill Kelly's show on 900 CHML in Hamilton. He did an event at the Lawrence TTC station to pitch his Buck a Ride plan. He did an event at the Science Center TTC station. Again, same idea. And then in the evening, late afternoon, early evening, an event with Mississauga supporters. So, I mean, here we go again. Barnstorm, 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 which you got to do if you're the least well-known of all the leaders.
Right. You know, respect the hustle, I believe the kids say. it's very reminiscent of the Ontario Liberal leadership race, where he won, you know, in large part just by, you know, outworking everyone. He, you know, was all over the province meeting Liberal supporters. You know, if you were a voting member in that race, you know, you had really good odds of meeting Stephen Del Duca and, you know, shaking his hand at some point. If Del Duca keeps up a schedule like this, nobody is going to be able to say that win or lose, he didn't work for it.
The Liberals also made a big announcement today as it related to class sizes. Del Duca wants to cap the size of classes in public schools at 20 students per class, and that would require the hiring of 10,000 more teachers. I guess we can assume that the teacher unions are pretty much on side with this announcement.
Yes, one could make the argument, certainly, that, part of the mission of any Liberal leader is getting the teachers' unions back on board. Teachers' unions largely backed the NDP in the last election, and that was a breakdown of a relationship that had existed between the party and teachers' unions for many years. But I don't think that's the only thing that's happening here, of course. You know, the Liberal brand is very closely associated with education policy generally. So you have Stephen Del Duca here promising to hire 10,000 new teachers. That would cost, the party has estimated, about $1 billion. Again, like the NDP, the Liberals have not provided a full costing yet, but the Liberals also have not provided their full platform. 10,000 new teachers is about 7.6% more relative to the 130,000 teachers that already exist in Ontario. But here's the part where I sort of point out the hitch, is that, like, the province doesn't actually hire teachers for the most part. School boards do. And there's all sorts of questions about a policy like this. You know, you don't just need the teachers, you need classrooms to put them in. That means physical buildings that are, sometimes very slow to build. Of course, the Liberals have also promised to build new schools, but, you know, you have to coordinate the hiring of personnel with the actual space that exists to instruct students in. In theory, this might work more quickly in a place like Toronto, where, at least in the public school board, there are excess school and classrooms around. But in fast-growing suburbs in the 905, where they simply don't have the room to teach the students that they already have, much less get, 1,000 more teachers in, Milton, let's say.
Well, one of the things that we like to do on this podcast daily is put the promises that the leaders make through a prism of critical analysis. And to be sure, there are, you know, great bumper stickers like Buck a Ride or, you know, 10,000 new teachers, you know, all that stuff looks good on a bumper sticker. But we want to dive down a little deeper and see how it would work. I think you've made some great points about some of the, you know, devil being in the details here. I'd add one more to that, which is, what about in some of the more remote parts of Ontario, where you've got maybe a class of 21 students? Are you telling me that the cap on class size at 20 would mean creating a whole new, you know, a whole new class for one student? Or, I mean, would they hire another teacher up there and a board that might not have as much money, cut the classes in two? I don't know. There's a lot of details around this that I think still have to be flushed out.
No, and this is why the Liberals, when they were in government, you know, they hedged their classroom size promises for exactly those reasons, right? The policy around classroom sizes that the Liberals endorsed, you know, has a lot of flexibility for exactly those kinds of issues. Now, obviously, they aren't in government, and they can make a bit more black and white promises, let's put it that way, and they'll leave execution to the problems if they make it into government.
I also noted the other day that when Stephen Del Duca was asked, okay, these are the schools you want to build, would you shut down any schools? He gave a categorical no. Now, anybody in public life has got to, or anybody who's followed public life has got to know that you can't make that kind of a commitment years ahead of fact. I mean, the reality is there are parts of this province where the population is going to be declining. And if a school doesn't have the student body to warrant its continuation, they're going to shut it down. So that's I don't know. I heard that promise, and to me, it sounded like a promise just begging to be broken.
Well, and the Liberals, of course, got into a lot of trouble in the late part of Kathleen Wynne's tenure when they were proposing to close schools, particularly in rural areas, which are losing, especially losing school age population, as you alluded to, became this incredibly difficult issue. They declared a moratorium on school closures across Ontario. That moratorium is still in place. The Tories left it and have not touched it. So at least in one sense, all Stephen Del Duca has to do to meet that promise is not do anything, even if he does win the election. But, you know, the reason why we talk about school closures is because, like, real circumstances are changing across the province. And we talk about declining rural populations, especially school-aged children. Like, at a certain point, you have these half-empty schools scattered across the province, and it costs money to maintain them. And, you know, the reason we talk about school closures is because somebody's got to pay for those.
Yeah. Here's where I do my little Bill Davis reference, because I knew you were waiting for it. Back in the 1960s, before he was premier, Bill Davis was the Minister of Education for Ontario for 9 years in the John Robarts government. And the province was booming so much, and the revenues were coming into the treasury so quickly that Mr. Davis often, on many days, opened 3 schools in a day. He would travel all over the province, cut the ribbon on one, get on a plane, go somewhere else, cut the ribbon on another. There were day after day after day after day when he would open 3 schools at a time. And so when it came time for him to run for the leadership, he knew everybody, and he'd been everywhere. So that's one of the advantages of being the Minister of Education.
Just while we're talking about this is also, I think, relevant to Stephen Del Duca. I mean, he was transportation minister under the Liberals and, you know, traveled all over the province, you know, for transit and highway projects while he was minister. And then there was a relatively brief period where he was out of the transportation portfolio, and he was the, oh gosh, it's one of those ministries.
Economic where the name, development, I think he was.
Yeah, but it was, they tacked on a bunch of other words too. But basically, the minister for ribbon cuttings and yeah, traveled all over the province, you know, announcing provincial funding for all sorts of, you know, small projects here and there. But these things matter because that's in part why Stephen Del Duca was able to go all over the province when he was running for the Liberal leadership. And yeah, people knew his name.
There you go. We should give some attention to the Green Party today. The Greens have a bit of a disadvantage in as much as their leader represents a riding in Guelph, Mike Schreiner, and he is tending to travel around parts of the province that are 2, 3, even 4 hours away from Toronto, so he doesn't necessarily get a lot of the coverage that the other leaders get when they spend time in Toronto. Mr. Schreiner, of course, going to the parts of the province where he thinks he has the best shot at winning some seats, but he did make a big announcement today promising to build 160,000 units of what he called affordable housing. What's that about?
Well, this is part of the broader green housing plan, and they started rolling this out last year, and I wrote about it at tvo.org. Our listeners can certainly find it there. You know, I think it would be fair to say that the Greens have the most aggressive housing plan on offer in the election right now. And of course, they can do that because, to be slightly unkind, nobody expects them to form a majority government at the end of all this. And so they can afford to be a bit ambitious and you know, maybe move the bar so that other parties have to follow them. You know, part of that plan is, you know, they have stuff about they want to end exclusionary zoning and really, you know, take a crowbar to municipal councils who are recalcitrant about approving new homes. But part of it is also building lots of affordable housing, partnering with co-ops, partnering with the nonprofit sector to really, you know, not just address the sort of market-rate housing needs in the province, but also to go after the affordable sector and really help people on lower incomes. I will note here, and we've said this a lot already, this podcast, about what we're waiting for. The Liberals do have a housing plan on the way, but I don't think it's coming this week, let me put it that way. Again, we will see it in the fullness of time.
In the fullness of time, yes, after full and frank discussions internally, no doubt. Let's talk about Doug Ford. Doug Ford, as we remind everybody, is still the Premier of Ontario, even though he runs what they call a caretaker government at the moment. In other words, no controversial decisions, just basically minding the store. But for the purposes of the campaign, we will refer to him as the leader of the Progressive Conservative Party of Ontario. And what did he hit the Liberals with today?
The main Tory attack of the day on the Liberals is over road tolls, basically saying that the Liberal government, when it was in power, imposed road tolls on various parts of the province, including two highways that connect to the 407 that the Tories now in power have since removed. The attack, I guess I bear some small responsibility for in one sense. I actually asked Del Duque about road tolls earlier this week because in all the discussion of their buck a ride province-wide policy proposal, Del Duque had said that he's a big believer in the role of prices to change people's behavior, to change their preferences, which I think is a totally defensible, even appropriate perspective for a policymaker. But historically, Stephen Del Duca was also one of the people who fought most against the idea of putting road tolls on the Gardiner Expressway and the Don Valley Parkway, which was an issue during the Wynne government. And so I asked him about that and asked him further whether the Liberals, if they were in fact elected to power, would they forswear any tolls on Ontario highways where they do not already exist? And he didn't answer the question very clearly. So the Tories clipped that out and they sent it around to the media today and, you know, I'll do penance for my sins or something.
There you
I
go.
Guess.
Making mischief again.
Yes.
Or maybe that's just called doing your job.
Well, I thought it was a fair question.
Indeed. All right. Let's talk about something that I think doesn't get a lot of play on the campaign trail, and that is the leadership and presentation skills of the four major party leaders. You know, I often get criticized when I write columns for TVO.org on overdoing the presentation skills differences among the leaders. But the fact of the matter is, when you talk to real people out there, that kind of stuff sticks. That's the kind of stuff that they remember, that they notice. You know, how well was somebody able actually to do a piece to camera and convince that voter that he or she was being genuine about what they were saying? So I think presentation skills matter. And one of the things, let's start in order of precedence from the last house. We'll start with Doug Ford. I find, well, you know what? Let's play the clip first, and then I'm going to come back and make a point, okay? Here's Doug Ford at his big Get It Done rally in Etobicoke at the Toronto Congress Center last night.
What energy, I'll tell you. What energy, and thank you for that incredible welcome.
Now, what's interesting about that, Mr. Ford mentioning the energy of the crowd and how energized it was and so on, that comment was on his teleprompter. It was part of the speech. I read the speech, and it had numerous references to the fact of Mr. Ford saying, "Wow, what energy." And I don't know. The man's been premier for 4 years. You figure he could ad-lib that and you wouldn't need that in the speech. But it raises the whole issue of the fact that 4 years later, Doug Ford is still pretty much unable to make a campaign announcement without reading it off the teleprompter. I think many Tories don't care at all. I think many people who don't like him find it incredible that his presentation skills have not really improved all that much to the point where he still even needs to read his ad-libs off a teleprompter. I don't know. What do you think?
I do think that once you bracket in the fact that he is still reliant on a teleprompter in ways that, you know, other political leaders are not, his speaking style has definitely improved relative to where it was 4 years ago. And certainly, I mean, you know, I did cover him a little bit when he was a Toronto City Councillor. You know, he is capable of ad-libbing. I've watched him do it. One of the problems for Doug Ford that I think his political staff know is that if he is given room to ad-lib, sometimes he gets himself in trouble. And so I think that might be part of why he is still so tightly scripted.
Like that comment about the Yahoos on the South Lawn of Queen's Park?
That, and also, I mean, some of the stuff when he was a Toronto City Councillor, speaking extemporaneously, you know, some of that stuff still, I'm sure, will find its way into attack ads now, you know, many, many years later.
All right, let's go on to the NDP leader, Andrea Horvath. How do you find her doing so far?
Well, you know, it's almost unfair to say this, but I mean, she's like the most experienced campaigner, so I expect her to continue to do well. I mean, she does speak, you know, she answers questions from reporters. You know, we are still grumbling a little bit about how we haven't gotten that fully costed platform, but that's like the reporter's job. But you know, she gives her comments, her speeches. She answers questions reasonably well. You know, every once in a while, you definitely see her trip up on something or have to correct a sentence. But again, she's the most experienced campaigner of the four leaders on the ballot this time.
I guess I'm going to be the designated curmudgeon here today because I'm also going to find, let me give her due where it is due. You know, she got this nickname of the Steel Town Scrapper because she represents a Hamilton riding, and she is a very personable person and talks about how she's going to fight for the little guy and this, that, and the other thing. But I am surprised from time to time that Ms. Horvath, who, as you point out, is the most experienced leader, this is her fourth general election as NDP leader, she still makes silly mistakes. She did an event in a riding recently where she was joined by one of her candidates with whom this was the third time she was doing an event, and she got the candidate's name wrong. And then there was another occasion as well at Queen's Park where she, to her credit, she doesn't read off a teleprompter. She just keeps a little cheat sheet of notes in front of her. I remember this press conference because she tried really hard to introduce the other MPPs who were with her, who were members of her caucus, and she didn't want to look at the cheat sheet. She tried to do it very naturally, and she sort of had to give up at one point because she realized, dang, I can't remember the riding or the critic portfolio of this MPP who she had been serving with for 3 years. So those kinds of moments can lead one to conclude, is she ready for prime time? Now, maybe these are human stupid mistakes and I'm overdoing it here, but again, I think presentation is important, and from time to time, she hasn't got the goods.
No, and I would add, you know, it might not matter, you know, a year before an election, 9 months before an election, when it's a press conference at Queen's Park that maybe six reporters are paying attention to, and it doesn't get clipped for the evening news. But, you know, those small mistakes, as small as they are, you know, if they happen, you know, in the middle of a campaign when you've got, you know, dozens of cameras pointed at you, even that small stuff can be really lethal to a campaign and to its energy. I don't think we've seen anything really devastating yet from any of the four leaders, but, you know, it absolutely can matter.
And I will give her due as well in saying that she is the only leader that has a campaign bus where she invites members of the media to come on her bus and basically, you know, I got nothing to hide here. Come on the bus, hang out with me, travel with me during the course of the day. I give her big props for that because most of the other leaders are, Doug Ford jokes about being in the bubble at Queen's Park. He's on the bubble on the road much of the time, too, trying to keep the journalists at bay. All right. Liberal leader Stephen Del Duca. Admittedly, we're on day two of the campaign, but what are your initial impressions of him?
Well, I mean, we already spoke a bit about the schedule that he's keeping. He's clearly, putting the work in. In terms of the events themselves, I mean, you and I have watched so many of these press conferences over the last 2 years, through a Zoom window or that kind of thing. I have yet to actually get to a Liberal event in person. I did hit a green one yesterday. I think he has a bit more energy than we are used to seeing from Del Duca. He would be the first to joke about how he's not like exactly the most charismatic speaker. I think he is, I don't know how else to put this except to say that he's really showing up for the campaign in a way that even a year ago, I think he would have, come off as a bit, lower energy, that kind of thing. And so, as far as the presentation that we're talking about here goes, I think Del Duca is doing well.
Yeah, I'm going to take my hat off to him as well, in as much as he never uses a teleprompter. He makes campaign announcements with barely a look down at his bullet point script. He really seems to know what he's talking about in as much as he's got the details, he's got the numbers, he's got the facts, pretty well committed to memory when he goes before the cameras and the microphones and articulates whatever the policy of the day is going to be. From time to time, his enthusiasm gets away from him. He did an announcement about Buck a Ride a few days ago, and in doing so, he started by saying, "I had the honor of taking the subway and the streetcar down to our location here near the Toronto waterfront, and I just remember thinking when I heard that, I don't think anybody feels honored to be taking the TTC these days, even though it's not as crowded as it once was before COVID, but still, it's still... Some days it's not great taking the TTC. Let's just put it that way.
I love the city and I love the subway and I love the transit system that keeps the city running, but nobody's proud to ride the subway.
That's right. We're not honored to take the subway anywhere. Yeah. So, listen, I'm being picky here, but those are those moments. But in the main, I'd have to say that he's in charge of his brief. He's really on his game. One thing I'd like to see, he still has his press conferences very choreographed. It's still the old one question, one follow-up thing, which, I don't know. I'm so much of two minds on that. On the one hand, it keeps things very civilized. On the other hand, and I write about this in a column on TVO.org if people want to follow up on that. On the other hand, these things get so antiseptic and very polite, and everybody's the kind of dynamic in a scrum that you used to get where there'd be a certain amount of tension and you could really go at the leader, like all that stuff's gone now. And I think as a result, the leaders, particularly the premier, can get away with skating a lot when they shouldn't.
Well, and to give Del Duca his due, the aforementioned question about road tolls, that was actually they gave me a second bite at the apple because I asked. I had already had my question and follow up, and then I discreetly asked, hey, can I get another question in? And they did allow me that, so I did appreciate that.
Okay, let's do the last of the major party leaders, and that would be Mike Schreiner, leader of the Greens. As we suggested earlier, doesn't quite get the attention that the other leaders do get. But what do you think of what you've seen so far? You watched his housing announcement today.
I did watch his housing announcement today. As I mentioned, I also went to an event in Beaches, East York yesterday because it was only a few minutes from my house, so I had no really good excuse not to go in person. Energized, speaking about a platform that he really cares about. I think some of the reporters at Queen's Park, we've occasionally joked that, it's really good news for the other three parties that there's only one Mike Schreiner, because he's actually, he's a very good communicator. He's managed, the impressive task of being a fourth party to win, a seat in the legislature. That doesn't happen a lot. And, if he manages to hold his seat in Guelph, that even just holding his own seat would be a pretty good accomplishment in this election. You know, he is realistic, I think is fair to say, about what the party's actual, you know, likely outcomes in this election. He's not expecting a green majority. But, you know, he is talking, I think, honestly about, you know, he has been able to do a lot as a single MPP for the Green Party, and he thinks if they were to get two or three or four MPPs, they could do more. And I'm saying that not to like give you his pitch for the Green Party, but you know it's refreshing, frankly, to hear one of the party leaders say, you know, like, yeah, we're not going to form government. That's not, you know, really what we're going to do here, but we can do a lot of good stuff, even within the bounds of, our what we are likely to accomplish.
Yeah. I think the line of his I like the most is I'm happy to have any party steal any of my material.
Right.
Right. He knows he's not going to be winning this election, and he's put out the policy that he thinks we need in order to get to the promised land, and he would be just delighted if any of the parties that end up forming government steal his ideas and implement them. And it's not every politician who says that, but as you say, Schreiner is realistic about his chances, and more than anything, he just wants to see some of his agenda implemented. All right, let's move on and talk about polling, because since we last recorded, there are four new public opinion surveys. I hasten to remind everybody, these are a wonderful indication of what people thought yesterday. They are not an indication necessarily of what people will do on June the 2nd. Main Street Research has a poll showing the Conservatives at 37%, with a 10-point lead over the Liberals at 27, New Democrats hot on their trail at 25, and the Greens at 6. Then you have a Léger poll, which again, very much mirrors what we just said. Conservatives 36, Liberals 29, New Democrats 25, Greens at 5, and the new Blue Party, which is this sort of more right-wing party, more to the right of the progressive conservatives, they're chiming in at 2%. So that's the first time I've seen them show up in a poll. Why don't you grab the next two?
Right. The third poll we have is from Earnscliffe. They have the Progressive Conservatives at 35%, the Liberals at 28%, the NDP at 24%, the Greens at 7%, and others at 6%. And then Innovative Research has the Tories at 37%, the Liberals at 29%, the NDP at 24%, and the Greens at 7%.
They're essentially all saying the same thing right now, which is that the majority government that the Conservatives would like is within reach, but might not be there yet.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, depending on which one of these polls you give the most credence to, right? I mean, if that Main Street result is correct and the Tories have a 10-point lead on the nearest party, they're probably looking at a pretty safe majority. But, you know, if that Léger poll is right, and maybe even, you know, if that Earnscliffe poll is right, you know, where the margins are smaller, you know, you could still be looking at a Tory minority.
Okay, partner, you got anything else for this wonderful day two of the campaign?
No, I mean, it's the second day. It already feels like the second week.
It's been busy. You know, the leaders, certainly the opposition leaders, are doing lots of events. So far, Doug Ford's holding it to about one a day. But of course, everybody knows who he is. He doesn't need further name recognition. The other guys do.
No, and I think, you know, if I were advising the Tories, this is exactly the kind of thing that you could imagine, you know, telling them, like, you're ahead in every poll. More events just gives you more chances to make an unforced error. Just keep it, you know, keep it slim, keep it, you know, keep it a simple schedule. And, you know, if things turn bad on you, then sure, maybe start doing more events. But for now, you know, save your energy.
Classic front runners play it safe strategy. And yep. When you said, if I were advising the Tories, my head almost exploded there, just to let you know. Okay, let's not have it explode before I get to read this closing.
Absolutely,
which is
not advising any party. Would not be allowed under TVO's policies or, God, my own inclinations.
Right on. And that's day two of this 43rd general election campaign. A reminder that we are here every weekday during the writ period right through to June the 2nd. JMM, we'll see you again out on the hustings.
See you tomorrow, Steve.